The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. May God bless the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Mitchell Energy Corporation versus the Honorable Clyde R. Ashworth and Catherine Adamski Gant, judges, original mandamus and prohibition proceeding, and Frank and Deborah Kolarsik versus James R. Emmons and others from Tarrant County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of the argument. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of our court, and you may purchase a tape of an argument from our clerk. We are ready to hear argument from relator in Mitchell versus Ashworth.
May it please the court that Mr. Jack O'Neill and Mr. Thomas Lewis will present arguments
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Jack O'Neill. Mr. Lewis and I represent the relator, Mitchell Energy Corporation. As the clerk of the court has just told the court, we reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal, and the rebuttal will be delivered by Mr. Tom Lewis. The case that we are here on this morning is one of 53 alleged groundwater contamination cases pending against Mitchell Energy Corporation in Wise County. Last year, in February, one of those cases was tried. Actually, it was seven of those cases that were consolidated in a widely publicized verdict against Mitchell that became known as the Bartlett case. That case, in February of last year, resulted in a $4 million judgment against Mitchell for actual damages and a $200 million judgment against Mitchell for punitive damages. It was after that verdict came down that I and Mr. Luce were asked to become involved in this litigation on behalf of Mitchell Energy. The issue that we are here on this morning in this case affects not only this case, but affects at least, in my judgment, 28 of the remaining 53 cases, because 28 of those 53 cases have yet to be assigned to a visiting judge or judges. The plaintiffs in this case have taken the position that those 28 cases ought to be split among as many as four or five additional judges, even though there's a single defendant, Mitchell Energy Corporation, in the cases, and the facts of the cases are substantially similar to the rest of them. We have taken the position that those 28 cases ought to be assigned to a single judge, Judge Sidney Farrar, who is presiding over 17 of those cases, known as the Bailey cases, which are currently set for trial March the 17th.
None of those issues are before us.
Your Honor?
You're giving us that information as background, but none of these issues are before us here. We can't do anything about those assignment of those cases.
That is correct, purely by way of background, because in my view, Your Honor, the decision of this court in this matter does not relate specifically to this case. It has broader ramifications, and that's the purpose of giving the background. The reason it has broader ramifications is that even though those other cases, 28 cases, have been awaiting assignment for some time, no assignment has been made of them. And I believe that Judge Ashworth, the presiding judge of the 2nd Administrative Judicial District, is probably waiting on the decision of this court before he decides to whom to assign those cases. In short, Justice Gonzalez, in my opinion, the decision of the court in this matter is not necessarily confined in terms of its ramifications to this case, but will probably affect the number of judges assigned to the remaining 28 cases, as well as to whom those cases are assigned. I do not intend, unless the court prefers otherwise by questioning, to talk to the court about who's done what to whom in this litigation, and I don't intend to respond to the plaintiff's allegations made in their brief that Mitchell has filed a barrage of objections to various judges as a delay tactic. In my judgment, the record speaks for itself. If I can now turn my attention to the specifics of this case, I regard the following facts as pertinent to the case we're here on today. First of all, the judge of the 271st District Court is Judge John Bostell. It is in his court that all of these 53 cases are pending, with the exception of the 7 already tried. They're now up on appeal in front of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals and scheduled for argument on March the 12th. We're here on the Nealon case. In the Nealon case, there are simply two plaintiffs, a husband and a wife. Mitchell filed a motion to recuse Judge John Fostell from the Nealon case. Judge Fostell refused to step down in that case. Judge Ashworth, the presiding judge of the Second Administrative Region, assigned Judge John Street to hear the motion to recuse. Mitchell objected to the assignment of Judge John Street to hear the motion to recuse. Judge Ashworth then assigned Judge Stephen Herod of Eastland, a district court judge, to hear the motion to recuse. No objections were filed to Judge Herod. A day-long hearing was held in front of Judge Herod, evidentiary hearing, and at the conclusion of that hearing, five days later, Judge Herod ordered the recusal of Judge Fostell. Following Judge Fostell's recusal, Judge Ashworth appointed Judge Catherine Gant to hear the merits of this case. We objected to the assignment of Judge Catherine Gant. Judge Ashworth refused to honor our objection to Judge Catherine Gant. The basis of the dishonoring of the objection, according to Judge Ashworth, is that under the applicable statute, which is 74.053 of the Texas Government Code, the way Judge Ashworth reads and implements that statute is that it allows one objection to a so-called senior judge. And in Judge Ashworth's view, a senior judge, and I don't disagree with his view of what a senior judge is, a senior judge is someone who has served on the bench a certain number of years. In the case of Judge Gant, after serving on the bench, went through the necessary prerequisites to notify this court that she wanted to become a judicial officer of the state. I believe Justice Phillips signed off on a letter certifying her as fit to sit, and she was a senior judge. According to Judge Ashworth, Judge Street was also a senior judge. When we exercised an objection to Judge Street, we used our single objection under 74.053 of the Government Code. And because Judge Street was a senior judge, and because Judge Gant is a senior judge, and because under Judge Ashworth's reading of the statute, we're only entitled to one objection to a senior judge, the second objection to Judge Gant was dishonored.
Have you ever taken the position that your strike of Judge Street did not count under the statute because that one strike rule only applies to assignments for trial?
Believe it or not, Justice Phillips, that was the point I was fixing to make. What I was going to say before leading in to the argument the primary argument that we're here on, the primary briefing in this case is done with how do you interpret Section 74.053D of the Texas Government Code, which allows unlimited strikes to a former judge who was not a retired judge.
That would also apply to judges who chose not to run for re-election.
That is correct.
And how would that, if that's the case, if it would apply to judges who were defeated as well as judges who chose not to run again, who are former judges, would that serve the legislative purpose that I believe you argued that it was passed to accommodate public concern about defeated judges serving?
Justice Cornyn, I'm going to answer your question, and then I'm going to come back if I can and deal with Justice Phillips' question. It is our position that the legislative history of this statute is clear. This statute was amended in 1991. Up until 1991, this statute unquestionably allowed only one strike against a judge, no matter whether the judge was defeated, retired, whatever, you only got one strike. In 1991, this statute was amended with the addition of subdivision D. 74053, paren, small d, close paren, was added. What that did was, that allowed unlimited objections to certain types of judges. I'm going to get into the legislative history in just a minute, but specifically to answer your question, it is our position that the legislative history of this statute is clear, and that under that legislative history, you determine whether a judge is a subsection D judge, i.e. whether the judge is a former judge who was not a retired judge, at the time the judge becomes a former judge, that is, at the time the judge leaves the bench. Under the legislative history of the statute, we think it's clear that in order for a judge to be the kind of judge that you have, we maintain Judge Gant as the kind of judge as to which you have unlimited objections. In other words, she is a former judge who was not a retired judge. Under the legislative history of this statute, we believe that you look at the time a judge has served as an elected judge. And if the judge has served 10 years, when the judge either steps down or is defeated, then under the current state judicial retirement system, that judge would have vested after 10 years of service, and that judge would be a judge as to whom you have only one strike.
How would it serve the legislative purpose, in fact, as a judge who chose not to run for re-election?
The legislative purpose of this statute, Justice Corman, is in front of the court in the record, volume 3, tab 15. In front of the Senate Jurisprudence Committee, there was a discussion about why amend this statute. Because remember, in 1991, this statute allowed only one objection to any kind of judge. And the key to understanding why the statute was amended by the insertion of a provision that allowed unlimited objections to certain types of judges is contained in a discussion between various senators, and one of the senators, Senator Glasgow, says the issue is that some members of the Senate don't want any defeated judge to have a right to serve as a visiting judge. That, if you look at the legislative history, is clearly what motivated the addition of subsection D. Various state senators were getting complaints that judges who had been defeated by the electorate were coming back, particularly in Harris County, and were serving as judges. The bill, the section we're concerned with here today, 74053D, was added as a result of a floor amendment by Senator Gene Green. And also in Volume 3 at tab 15, there is a discussion of what does subdivision D mean and what was it intended to accomplish. And I would respectfully submit that any legislative analysis by this court of the statute ought to focus on three questions. What was the statute like before it was amended? Why was the statute amended to add subdivision D? And I've just covered that. And what does subdivision D mean? What was it intended to accomplish? And if the court will look at, in the record, the Senate, full Senate session on May the 21st of 1991, there is considerable discussion about what subdivision D means. I'm not going to go all the way through it, but let me just say that Senator Carriker posed a question to Senator Green about subdivision D. And keep in mind, subdivision D is the subdivision that allows unlimited strikes to a former judge who was not a retired judge. And Senator Carriker says, Senator Green, what would be the case under subdivision D where a judge was appointed to fill out 1 year of a term, was reelected to that term for a four-year term, was reelected one more time, and served as 4 years. That makes him 9 years. What would that judge be a subdivision D judge? And let me stop here and say that is Judge Gant. Judge Gant, and the record is undisputed on this, served on the 360th, I believe, district court bench, which I think is a family court bench, for 4 years from 84 to 88. She was defeated in 1988. Between 88 and 90, apparently she accrued 2 years of service as a visiting judge. She was elected again in 1990 and served a four-year term from 1990 until 1994. She was defeated again in 1994. From 94 to 96, she apparently served as a visiting judge. Then in the summer of 96, processed her papers to become a senior judge, was then assigned to this case, and we then objected to her. In short, when she was defeated the second time, she had 8 years of elected service on the bench, not enough time for her retirement to vest.
Let me ask you, you said elected service. My reading brief said she was appointed and then lost an election, then appointed and then lost an election. But she did win some elections in the process.
She won two elections, Justice Enoch, and she was defeated twice. And the legislative colloquy that we're looking at here indicates very clearly to me that when you have a situation where a judge is an elected judge and is not served time as an elected judge for 10 years, enough time to vest, that judge is not a judge against whom you have only one strike. That judge clearly falls within subdivision D. I see that my time is up, and
you
I have not
answer
answered
question.
Your question. May
you
I
may
answer,
answer
your question? The question that Justice Phillips was asking, I think, is an important one, because if the court were to decide this case based upon the issue raised by Justice Phillips, the court would not need to reach the question of interpreting subdivision D and what the words a former judge or justice means for this reason. Justice or Judge Street, who was assigned to this case, first, he was assigned to hear the motion to recuse. He was not assigned to hear the entire case. If the intent of 74053 is to give a litigant, and I'm talking now not about the multiple objection part of 74053D, I'm talking about the single objection part in 74053D. If the intent of that single strike provision is to give a party a single strike against a judge who is assigned to hear, it says assigned to hear the case. If that means assigned to hear the merits of the case, then Judge Street was not assigned to hear the merits of this case. He was assigned to hear the motion to recuse. And then that would make Judge Gant the first judge assigned to hear the merits of this case. Consequently, our objection against Judge Gant would be a valid objection, because it would be the first exercise of a single strike against Judge Gant. I believe the intent of the statute has to be that you are allowed a single strike against a judge assigned to hear the merits of the case, not a judge who was assigned merely to hear a motion to review.
But you didn't, just a yes or no answer, you didn't brief that point at all?
No, sir.
All right. Next question. What was Judge Street's status? Was he, had he served enough elected terms that he was a retired judge by virtue of that?
Yes, sir.
And if he had not, if he had been in a situation where he was still a former judge, he's under 60, and let's make it clear, he's under 60 and has not served for 10 years, then you could make that strike and you would still have one clean strike against a senior.
Correct.
But there's no question Judge Street was a retired judge by anybody's definition.
By anyone's definition, Judge Street had served enough time as an elected judge to be a one-strike judge rather than a 74053D judge.
Any other questions?
Did
Any
you say questions? Just a second ago that the party should have unlimited strikes with regard to a judge who has been assigned to hear a recusal motion?
Well, I did not address that.
Oh, I thought I just heard you say that a minute ago before you...
Justice Abbott, I did not address that, and in all candor, I have not thought about the answer to that question.
Fine. Well, that's fine then.
But that is the necessary
It's the logical conclusion that would follow from my answer to Justice Phillips's question.
Well, if that is the case, then what would prevent, say, a party involved in a case in Houston to go through 25 strikes of all the civil judges there, or however many judges they want to put up?
Well, you have to keep in mind that you still have, in Houston, I'm familiar with the situation there, it'd be hard to exercise that many strikes, because sooner or later you're going to get to a judge who is a one-strike judge. Of the sitting judges in Houston, some of them are, under my reading of this statute, and I'm familiar with one in particular, who, under my definition of the statute, would be a judge against whom multiple strikes.
But you said that system shouldn't apply in this, what you said. I don't want to belabor the point, but you said assigned to hear the case means assigned to hear the merits of the case, so that any judge who cannot be assigned pursuant to Rule 330, exchange of benches, or not even exchange, just one judge acting for another in an urban county, would be subject to the strike, so that if you were in a county that only has one district judge, say Hill County, under your reading, you could, if there was a recusal motion against the Hill County judge, a party could exercise strikes forever until we exhausted the entire sitting and former judiciary.
Under my reading of the statute, there are multiple objections that are allowed to a judge who does not have 10 years of elected service at the time the judge is either defeated or steps down.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. William Kirkland, who is in argument for respondents.
May it please the court, I, along with Ms. Hollingsworth, represent the real parties and interests in this case, Mr. and Mrs. A.H. Nealon. We firmly believe that this court should deny this petition, dissolve this stay order, and allow this case to be tried before the judge who was assigned to this court. Judge Ashworth did not clearly abuse his discretion when he overruled the latest objection of Mitchell to the latest assigned judge in the case, Judge Gant. Judge Phillips, to answer your question, there's a case that is exactly on point called Holmes versus Lanford, which is cited on page 13 of our brief, which says you get one strike per case, regardless of whether it's on a motion to recuse, whether it's on the merits of the case, you get one strike per case. This point was not briefed, it was never brought forward to this court, but that case, along with 74053B, clearly says that when you lodge an objection, you get one per case. Now, there are certain undisputed facts in this case that nobody can contest. Number one, before Judge Gant was appointed or assigned to this case, she had left the bench. She had left the 141st Judicial District Court in Tarrant County. She was defeated, and we readily acknowledge that. But it is not relevant to the court's consideration of this issue. After she left the bench, she served time throughout the state on the bench, and then on June 20th of 1996, she became a retiree under the system. 74.0413 defines what that retirement was. She accumulated enough time on the bench. She had attained the age that was necessary. And then on July 2nd of 96, she made an appropriate election under 75001 to become what the code is called a senior judge. Now, it is critical that the court understand that 75.001 is critical in this case. It's a procedure that allows judges who have taken retirement to make an election with this court to become a senior judge to sit and hear cases. That statute is not without consequences. It allows a judge who has retired to actually obtain the status of a senior judge and be appointed to hear a case. Now, why is that important? Because it is that status that insulates a judge from an unlimited objection, which is provided for in the code to former judges.
Do you agree the legislature intended to give unlimited strikes against judges who were defeated?
Provided they are not a retired judge at the time of assignment, yes.
So if they serve by assignment, then that sort of may become rejuvenated or reconstituted to eliminate that concern? Or
I don't know if it's rejuvenated, but whether they leave the bench of their own volition, whether they become ill, whether they're defeated, if they accumulate time subsequent to that such that they become a retiree and then make the election and become a senior judge, they are a retired judge. Nowhere in the statutes of this state or any case law is there any hybrid sort of judge that talks about, well, you're a real retired judge if you retain retirement before you leave the bench. But if you attain retirement and become a senior judge after you leave the bench, you're not a real judge. There's no distinction in the law whatsoever for that. And that is the distinction that Mitchell has manufactured in this case.
But why does that not skirt around the intent that the legislature wanted to achieve?
Well, I believe that it does skirt the intent. Mitchell's position does skirt the intent.
No, what I'm talking about is the fact that the judge, in this case, Judge Gant, is reconstituted, as stated, by now accumulating her 10th year after she had been defeated.
Because the intent of the 91 amendment, in my view, and in my client's view, was to exact out of the category of former judges and therefore be subject to unlimited strikes a retired judge. One must remember that 75001, which provides for the election whereby Judge Gant became a senior judge, was law in 1989. It was on the books 2 years before the 1991 amendment. The legislature knew when it passed that amendment and made a retired judge a one-strike judge that a judge could become retired after they left the bench, whether they were defeated, whether it was an intentional retirement. They knew that that law existed. The intent of the 1991 amendment, Your Honor, in my view, was to exact out of this former judge unlimited strikes category a judge who had become a retired judge. What the way the statute read before the amendment is that you had one strike, regardless of whether you're a retired judge, an active judge, or whether you attained retirement after you left the bench. The amendment came in and said, no, for active judges and retired judges, you get one strike only. Now, that is for former judges, true former judges. That is, a judge who's not retired. You have unlimited strikes. If one reads the Senate debate, you will discover that the Senate went to great lengths to exact out of this former judge unlimited strikes category the retired judges. And when one realizes that on the books at the time of this amendment was 75001, which clearly provided that a judge could attain retirement and senior status, after that judge left the bench, one must presume the legislature knew what it was doing by exacting retired judges out of that unlimited strike category. So it is our view that when you read the legislative intent, it supports our position that a retired judge, such as Judge Gant, does fit the definition of 74053. The category that this court must construe when it is making this...
Let me ask you this real quick about what you're talking about. What do you think is, looking at subsection D, what do you think is the significance of the word was?
Just what I was going to say. There are two views before you. Our view is that was refers to the time when the assignment was made. Now, Mitchell wants was to refer to when the judge left the bench. The more logical interpretation, in our view, is was refers to when the time the assignment was made. A former judge or justice who was not a retired judge at the time of the assignment. That means you have an unlimited strike. If when the presiding judge appoints the judge to hear the case, if that judge is not an active or retired judge, then you have unlimited strikes.
Fine, if that's your right, 7405-4A2 talking about assignment use is a retiree. And it clearly is referable back to the date of the time.
Well, 74053 is the statute that I believe is the one we're discussing.
I understand that, but I'm talking about other language in the same chapter.
Because I think it refers to a different situation. We're talking about an objection under 74053. They address objections, so when you're talking about was, it presumes a past tense. That's when the assignment was made. That's what differs those two statutes. 74053 specifically is entitled and specifically deals with objections to judges.
I'm just going to ask you, under canons of construction, can a court add a phrase, as you suggest, to a statute to achieve a result?
Well, I think this court can make a reasonable interpretation based on what it believes the legislative intent.
But isn't there case law that says the court may not add language to an existing statute to achieve a result?
Absolutely.
So how can we add at the time of the assignment?
Well, because I don't think you're adding language. I think we are asking that you interpret was to mean at the time of the assignment. Unfortunately, Judge, both parties are asking this court to interpret was based on the legislative intent.
So your answer would be that Relator is asking us to add a phrase at the time that you left the bench to interpret was.
That's what Mitchell is asking this court to do. We are simply asking this court to construe was to mean at the time of assignment, which is, after all, what the subject of the statute is. I mean, the subject of this statute is assignment and objections. Having was refer to that period of time is an absolutely logical step for this court to do when it is interpreting what 74053D actually means.
Mr. Kirkman, let me ask you, your interpretation, would it not be possible for every former judge to ultimately become a retired judge under the statute under your interpretation? I mean, Judge Gant won some elections, but when the statute was originally passed, I guess it was possible for a judge to have never won an election and sit as a former judge or not. Would they have to have at least won one election?
No. Winning an election has absolutely nothing to do with the interpretation of this.
So it's possible that anybody who's appointed a district judge and then loses the election can get assigned as a judge and then serve for another 10 years as under assignment and become retired?
Well, that's what the code provides. A judge, take an absurd example. Let's assume that a judge is appointed for 3 days and loses an election and then sits for 10 or 15 years by assignment such that they put in the appropriate time. Under the code, they become a retiree. Under 75001, if that judge makes an election and certifies to this court that they've served a number of years and taken the CLE and have sat by assignment for X number of years, then they become a senior judge entitled to retired status under that particular statute.
Then what would be the purpose? What would be the purpose then for the legislature saying that a former judge is subject to unlimited strikes, but retired judges are not, if in fact, over a period of time, all former judges become retired judges?
Well, it's not a point in fact that they do. They have the right to. I think the reason is there is nothing to suggest that a judge who happened to attain retirement status and become a senior judge after, I've lost train of thought, there's nothing to suggest that a judge who attains retirement status after they leave the bench by sitting, by hearing cases, has any less ability to run a court than one who takes retirement before they leave the bench. A former judge is a judge who hasn't, by definition, had enough experience on the bench, has had 1 or 2 years, whether they were elected or not, but haven't had the experience to judge cases. And I think that is the type of judge that the legislature was pointing at when they said, we want to give some litigants unlimited objections to that kind of judge. If you put in the time and you sit on the bench, it is presumed that you're going to gain the experience and have that ability to make decisions. There has to be a line of demarcation somewhere. There's nothing in the legislative history that convinces me that the legislature believed that a person who took retirement and put in the time on the bench was any less qualified to judge a case than a true judge who retired before they left the bench.
What do you make of the exchange between Senator Carriker and Senator Green during the floor debate of this bill that's cited in the briefs?
Well, I make of them exactly what is said. In my view, the first exchange, if I'm got my notes correct, where Senator Carriker asked what would the case be where a judge was appointed to fill out a 1-year term, was reelected to that term for a 4-year term, and was reelected one more time as a judge for a 4-year term, that makes 9 years, and then one of these big party sweeps in a national election comes along and that judge is swept out of office. simply on the basis of partisan votes that had nothing to do with his service. Green then said that judge could still sit as a visiting judge, but under the language that we put in there, that party to a case can't object to that judge. It doesn't say anything. I mean,
The next
exchange?
What Senator Character's retort was.
Well, I don't, there's nothing that I read into that, because anybody can object to an active judge or a retired judge and have one objection. So I don't read anything into that to support Mitchell's position. I mean, again, I think what these senators were trying to do was exact out of these unlimited objections those judges who retired, and there's nothing to suggest that they had to retire before they left the bench. You know, another very important point for this court to consider is if Mitchell's position is to be followed by this court, think about the burden that it will put upon the heads of the administrative regions throughout the state when they are forced to appoint judges to cases where disqualifications and recusals are prompt. It is my experience that the process of disqualifying and recusing judges has proliferated tremendously in the last 2 years. If the presiding judge of a region is burdened with this unlimited strike rule for retired judges, think about the small pool that it would give them to appoint what I would call a bulletproof judge. Those judges who retire from the bench and take their retirement before they leave the bench, in all candor, are judges who really don't want to serve. I mean, they've had lawyers all their lives. They've tried a lot of cases. I'm not sure that they're the kind of judges that would take a Mitchell Energy case. And if these judges are subject to unlimited objections, the pool of judges that the administrative judge has to assign to the cases has dwindled substantially. And you know what that does? That fosters judge shopping for a particular litigant. It fosters this continual objections to judges time after time after time, which doesn't serve the administration of justice. When a judge has an ability to appoint a judge that he knows will not be subject to being stricken, then I think he's got some confidence that he can appoint a judge and the case will go on. The point being that if Mitchell's position is bought, the pool of judges that are so-called one objection or bulletproof judges and available to sit is really small.
Now, what do you base that? I saw it in your brief and I hear it here, but I just don't see it in the numbers. The presiding judges issued a report yesterday on who's around to assign.
Well, I mean, I'm a prisoner of my own experience. I mean, I know that within my judicial region, I can tell you
that. Go up to the 6th floor of the Office of Court Administration and pick up their data on who's assigned.
I have, and it is my belief and understanding that true one-objection judges, that is, judges who were willing to sit and who were retired at the time they left the bench, are few and far between to appoint to this case. In other words, the judges who retired after they left the bench, there is a number of those judges who are available to sit in my particular region, who this Judge Ashworth could appoint, and then only have that one objection rule apply.
But the consequence of limiting the pool of judges who can preside over a case because of the unlimited strikes results in litigants being forced to go before, most likely, the elected judge for the area where the case is pending, which is one of the things that the legislature wanted to achieve. And then secondly, the alternative would be that the litigants would most likely have to go before the type of judge who had qualified for 10 years at the time the appointment was made.
Well, I would disagree with that, because I don't think this situation comes up until you have some question raised as to the elected judge. I mean, usually if the elected judge has had some recusal motion filed or disqualification, so the judge has to step in and make some appointment of some judge. And my point is, if the judge hasn't got very many one objection or bulletproof judges, and he has to keep appointing people where there is unlimited objections, it just fosters continual overturn. And if a judge who simply took retirement after they left the bench sat the number of years, made the election, is in fact a one objection judge, then the presiding judge has more of a pool available, which he can make an appointment that he knows will stick. Because otherwise, he's just appointing former judges strike, former judges strike, former judges strike. And because of the fact that you have this unlimited objections to former judges, it just never ends.
You're assuming that every former judge is going to be stricken. It does not follow. There's going to be objections for every judge.
Well, of course, as long as it's provided and you have the ability, I must presume that one would exercise that right. I mean, I think the legislature says we can't have these unlimited objections, and that's why they kept in the one objection limitation to active judges and retired judges. And there's nothing that persuades me to show that the one objection to a retired judge shouldn't apply to a judge just because they took retirement after they left the bench, regardless of whether they resigned or they lost the election. Wherefore, premises considered, we would respectfully pray that this court deny this petition and dissolve this stay order.
Any other questions?
Yes, on that subject. How is the stay impacting the litigation?
How is the stay impacting litigation?
Yes.
We've got a case that's over 6 years old. We've been stayed since August of 1996 before the Court of Appeals. We briefed the entire case, had oral argument. They dismissed it. They came up here. We haven't been able to get the lawsuit to trial.
Is it currently set?
Well, it was. It was set, and in the latest stay by this court, quite that setting out, it would be my hope that if this court dissolves the stay order, we would get an immediate setting and get to trial ASAP.
Is there, in your view, pretrial work to be done before the case can be tried?
From the plaintiff's viewpoint, there is very little pretrial work.
Thank you.
Before you sit down, let me ask you a question. How do you respond to the allegation, this is not a six-year-old case, but this is actually a few months old case because of the numerous new allegations that have been made and new experts that have been listed, new fact witnesses and experts that have been outlined. So it's a relatively young case as a result of the amendment of pleadings and the new experts that have, and fact witnesses that have been disclosed.
Judge, I could probably go on for days about this.
Give me a minute on that.
Well, this litigation has been hotly contested for over 3 years. These people's groundwater has been polluted by the gas transportation of Mitchell Energy. This is one of 52 cases. These people have conducted discovery nonstop for two and a half years. They know everything there is to know about gas and its migration. They know everything to know about how gas migrates into these people's water. This particular lawsuit can be tried in 2 months if this court would dissolve this stay order. These people have experts coming out the wazoo. They have spent tons, thousands, millions of dollars defending this case and other cases that are similar. They are prepared and ready to go.
Any other questions? Thank you, Cal.
Mr. Chief Justice and distinguished justices of the court, let me just say on a personal note, my very brief career as Chief Justice of this court did nothing but enhance my understanding of the difficulty of your job, but also my respect for this institution. And I think that's what's involved here today is respect for the judicial system in this respect. I think what you're presented with is as you look at the legislative history here of this statute, a clear understanding that what the legislature was trying to do was deal with the issue of public respect for the judicial system. Now, my personal preference would have been that the legislature deal with that by dealing with the issue of how we elect our judges. But that's not where the legislature was in 1991. Instead, they were dealing with an issue where there was a rising chorus of discontent about the use of visiting judges, in particular, who had been defeated in elections. And I would submit it is beyond dispute, and I think that's exactly the question that you were raising, Justice Corman, that the legislative history here was very clearly to deal with that issue. They considered several extremes. They considered the extreme of saying that you could not use a former judge who had been defeated, and they rejected that absolute view. Instead, as often legislatures do, they struck a compromise. Dealing with the issue, they struck a compromise, and that is exactly what they did in the statute that they passed. They increased the circumstances under which you could have unlimited objections. Now, I realize sitting in your shoes, you're dealing with the issues of administration of justice, the fact that we need more courts, the fact we need more judges. But I think an overriding concern of everyone, justices, officers of the court, is respect for the judicial system. And I think that's what the legislature was trying to deal with here in this situation. I had a very unique experience 7 or 8 years ago. I happened to attend a seminar on Thomas Jefferson just about the time that the Berlin Wall was falling. And there was a professor there, a constitutional expert by the name of Dick Howard, who I'd gotten to know many years before, who at that time was serving as a consultant to Eastern European countries as they struggled to write new constitutions to embrace democracy. And over lunch one day, he said, you know, they don't have any difficulty understanding the role of the executive branch. They don't have any difficulty understanding the role of the House of Representatives, the Senate. But they sure have a problem in understanding the judicial branch. They have difficulty understanding how in a democracy you can have elected representatives pass statutes and then have judges look at those statutes and decide what the legislature meant. But he said, you know, I think if they embrace everything but respect for the independence of the judiciary, those countries will never really have the form of government that we have. And I think that's what the legislature was struggling with, because underpinning the independence of the judiciary is respect for the judiciary. Without public respect for the judiciary, that independence inevitably declines. And we're in a funny situation in this state where we say on the one hand to voters, you should elect your judges. That's important. And then we turn right around and say, but if a judge is defeated, it's okay if they hear your case. Now again, I would rather deal with a core issue, which is the way we select our judges. But until we come to grips with that, we're going to have situations like the legislature dealt with in 1991. And I think it is very clear that they were trying to deal with public respect for the judiciary. And again, it doesn't matter. I mean, what they were dealing with was perception of the use of defeated judges, no matter what the qualifications.
Yes, sir? Let me ask a question about your interpretation statute. If a judge has otherwise served and eligible to retire and then just chooses not to run but doesn't make the election to retire and leaves office, would your interpretation prohibit them, I mean, would subject them to unlimited strikes if after they left office they decide to sit as a visiting judge?
It would depend on the amount of time they'd serve because of the compromise by the legislature.
Well, I'm assuming that they're eligible to retire. December 31st, at the end of their term, they could retire. But they chose not to exercise the election to retire and sit as a visiting judge. They just left office to go do something else. And then they come back and decide they want to sit as a visiting judge. Would they be subjected to unlimited strikes under your interpretation?
I think if they have served the requisite 10-year period and therefore they have passed the test of time, as the legislature phrased it, then they can be used in that category.
So your view would be the was would apply eligible for retirement at the time they left office, and if they were eligible for retirement at the time they left office, then they'd be subject to one strike.
Yes, and I think clear in the use of the word was and the use of the word is, it's very clear that if the interpretation that the plaintiffs want in this case was what the legislature was intended, they very clearly would have used the word is. I mean, it would have been a very simple word to use and would have been very clear. But here, the use of the word was there very clearly because of the legislative history. And I would simply read to And Justice Gonzalez was getting to that point in the dialogue with opposing counsel. Here was Senator Carrick's response in the rebuttal. He said, okay, so under the original bill, and also with the amendment you're placing on the bill, a person who was defeated without having reached vested retirement would be able to serve as judge so long as no party objected. I see my time is up, but I would urge this court that the overriding concern is respect for the judiciary, and that the legislature chose to deal with that subject in the compromise they reached, and that compromise should be honored. Thank you for your time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument.